Forces, Forces Radio.
This is BFBS. Original Forces programs. A Submariner's Tale.
One of my jobs was to stand under the main access hatch and check for leaks. And I often gave it some ponder. What if that actually did start to leak?
My way of dealing with it, I prefer just to shut it off. That part of my life is gone until I come back.
There were occasionally times your instinct cut in, and people talk about the hairs on the back of your neck, and you could recognise that something wasn't perhaps quite right.
There is a company of men, and now some women, who spend their time below the waves. Their Royal Navy colleagues refer to them as sun dodgers, but they are submariners. They live in very expensive and highly capable tin cans under the sea for months at a time, waiting and watching and listening. Some of them gathering information and watching for enemy vessels. Some of them silent, unseen, carrying a deadly cargo of nuclear Armageddon to rain upon the Queen's enemies should the need ever arise. For the next half hour, we shall hear a few submariners' tales.
Hi, I'm Commander Southwood, and I have been a submariner for 23 years. I joined as a PO stoker. It allowed me to come through the artificer branch, which is now the engineering technician, up to the warrant officer rank and commander. So I would say that the submarine service has done me very well.
Hello, I'm Commodore Mike Wallacker, Commander British Forces Gibraltar, but a submariner by profession, 20 years in submarines from the late 80s to 2008. And in my time, I served first in a conventional submarine in Faslane, mostly Trafalgar-class submarines, including commanding HMS Tireless, then latterly the first commanding officer of HMS Astute.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Commander Duncan Filippo, and in Gibraltar here, I'm the nuclear engineer. My last job was as the Marine Engineer Officer of HMS Astute, which meant I was responsible for the department that ran power, propulsion and hotel systems throughout the submarine. So that's everything from the nuclear reactor to the toilets.
My name's Ali Barber, I'm a Chief MA. I am the Command Radiation Protection Supervisor for HQBF at Gibraltar. My next draft for a submarine is HMS Talent. I join that on the 8th of May.
My name's Steve Lawson, and I used to be in the Navy. I joined in 1979, and I served on submarines from 1981 right through until I retired in 2007. I served on diesel boats and HMS Turbulent and Resolution-class Polaris submarines.
My name is Lieutenant Tregaron Hammond. I'm the OC of Windmill Hill Signal Station. And for the first 5 years of my Royal Naval career, as a weapons engineer mechanic brackets radio, so an able rate right at the beginning, I served on Trafalgar-class submarines.
BFBS, original forces programmes.
A Submariner's Tale.
The submarine service has evolved from World War I diesel-powered boats to the first Polaris-carrying boats of the Resolution class, through the Trafalgar-class hunter-killer submarines still in service today, the Vanguard-class submarine, which carries our constant at-sea deterrent, and the Astute-class hunter-killer, all of which have done, and some that still do play, their part in the defence of our realm. Apparently taking people, life support, weapons and a whole load of nuclear under the sea takes a lot of skill.
HMS Astute was the first of class and to all intents and purposes was a prototype. If you get your car, someone like Ford produces hundreds of Ford Mondeos or whatever before they release it to the public. So yes, it will work perfectly. Submarines are a little bit more complicated, being compared to the space shuttle in terms of complexity. In fact, it's probably more complex than that, bearing in mind you have a nuclear power station inside a submarine with all the weapon systems as well. It's a very complicated bit of kit, hence it needs lots of highly qualified and experienced people to look after it.
The thing about the submariners is everybody is trained to respond to those environments. For example, every submariner gets his dolphins. The dolphins are something where you must do an SMQ or BSQ board, which is you must know where every single valve on board is that allows water into the submarine. So if you're at 300 metres or 200 metres and there was a leak, the water comes in very quickly and you can't wait for a specialist engineer to come up and find which valve it is. You may be the chef, you may be the captain. You have to know how to stop those things. So therefore, the reliance on everybody and the accepting that everybody has their place makes it a great family unit, which I think is special to the submarine service.
Did you always see yourself as one of the elite when you were on a submarine?
Absolutely, yeah. We always did. Yeah. I think perhaps the main thing that brings all submariners together is that everybody has to pass the same exam, from the youngest steward up to the XO going to a new submarine that he's never been on before. Everybody has to learn the same things about their submarine. So there is definitely, across the whole boat, from front to back, up to there, up, down, everybody has a knowledge. And everybody knows that everybody else has that knowledge. And it brings everybody together. And it's a far more detailed knowledge about their working environment than I'm aware of in any other branch of the Navy.
Do you see yourself as one of the elite when you look at the surface flotilla?
I look at it this way. I am qualified to do their job. I can do any general service medic role, but yet they are not qualified to do mine. So, yeah, I'm elite.
Apart from the dolphins on their uniform, which are worn by all qualified submariners, there is one thing that unites every boat.
Definitely the smell. In fact, when I used to come back off patrol and I would come home, my wife would not let me through the door until I'd had a shower or three baths or a de-louse or whatever it was, because the smell of
UK
diesel and
you could walk onto
sweat
a submarine,
and oil and all of those smells are definitely embedded in you. When you come back, you just can't get rid of the smell. And even today, if my wife's out, we'll meet somebody or we go into the dockyard or something and she goes, oh, he's a submariner. You don't need to look at the man.
And again, I wouldn't even begin to describe what it's a mixture of, but there is something that is, it is probably a unique atmosphere on board, from sort of every sort of sensory that you can imagine, from sight to hearing to smell. You just know you're in a submarine.
Yes, they have a delightful aroma of a mixture of sweaty people and OX30 oil.
There is a distinctive submarine smell. It's quite hard to describe, but I find it quite homely. And even now, I sort of pull out bits of kit that have obviously spent a lot of time at sea, and they've still got the smell on it. And it sort of takes you back.
And you have a quick sniff, do you?
Yeah.
Diesel boats, you obviously stank of diesel. You couldn't get away with it. Diesel impermeated everything. I was always told, because you can't smell it yourself, that the nuclear boats smelt more of... You smelt more like of cabbage.
Yeah, we did shower, but we did stink in equal measure. And some people just choose not to shower. There was a particular supply officer, I remember, who could pretty much grow mushrooms under his armpits. He just chose to be a pungent chap, but there it is. Oh, we'd tell him he stank and he didn't care. But for Sunday lunch, he would have a shower, thankfully. So once a week.
BFBS, Original Forces Programmes. A Submariner's Tale.
When one of the Royal Navy's ballistic missile boats, known as SSBNs or bombers, goes away on patrol, there are no letters, no emails, no comms, no nothing. Just a family gram, which can be sent by family and friends and is vetted by numerous Navy personnel. 120 words a week, and it gets to the boat only if there's room on the signal. These family grams are never answered by anyone on board. To some, their presence can be a help or a hindrance.
In my day, we only received them on Polaris patrols, and they were 40-word messages then, which came over the VLF broadcast. So they came in very, very slow. They only came in when there was space, when operational traffic wasn't taking up the full routine, and they were a nightmare. 40-word family gram would take 2 or 3 minutes to come in, and a Polaris submarine would never, ever transmit. So there was never any traffic from the submarine back to families. It was always a one-way flow. So the families had to write, or try and write, without giving any bad news or whatever, yeah. As the XO, I read all of them. When they came in, to vet them, and they'd already been vetted by the other crew when they're ashore to make sure there was nothing. And if there was anything, the family would get phoned up and say, you know, say Harold's died, so they'd phone up and Harold was the tortoise or whatever. But then, yeah, I had to read them all. Because they had to be innocuous, they were boring.
Well, it was a double-edged sword with those family grams, because it's only 40 words, you don't get so much, and they do edit them, so no bad news, so only good news to get you cheered up. But I'll tell you what, when you are in that queue to receive a family gram and it doesn't come in, obviously you're gutted. But equally, when you do get a family gram, you're absolutely elated, and even though it's only 40 words, but it makes a huge difference. So I'm very pro, like I say, for the time you do get them, even if it's just the dog's fine, it makes a world of difference.
You'll have heard both sides of stories about family grams. You'll hear people say that they were a waste of time. You'll hear some people who say they couldn't sort of live without them. The ones I do remember, perhaps not me specifically, were in command on patrol, where you know you're not coming back for 5 or 6 weeks, and you see a sort of drop in the atmosphere somewhere and discover that somebody's had a family gram that has got through the sensor, but perhaps has given news that's not been particularly good. That's quite disappointing.
When I first started on submarines, we had little help with technology. Mobile phones hadn't even existed, and neither did the internet. So we used to get mail at harbour stations twice. I think that life has got easier on board now because there's more communication with people ashore through emails and the internet. However, sometimes when you get told stuff when you're at sea on a submarine, there's little you can do about it, and you can't really help your family when you're away. So that is a downside.
If it had been me, I would have said, don't bother, to my wife, don't bother. There's no point. What you know? You're not telling me anything I need to know or particularly want to know. You can say, well, I never had any problems with dealing with it, but my way of dealing with it, I prefer just to shut it off. That life, part of my life, is gone until I come back. And just dipping into it with a 40-word message a week was, for me, not a good way of doing it. And seeing the reaction it had on some of the guys on the boat when either they got bit of news they weren't expecting, or their family gram was late. If they didn't get a family gram for like 11 or 12 days, whoa, some of them, yeah. So it, for me, it wasn't a good way of doing it.
When the boat is away, it carries everything it needs. It is its own life support. Those on board are trained to the highest level, which is a good thing. An emergency at 1,000 feet would certainly focus the mind.
During my time in submarines, there were a couple of occasions I can particularly remember back in the very early days, a flood on board where we were quite deep and all of the actions were correctly taken. But there is a moment in that you're not absolutely certain, you can't quite feel as it's starting to move upwards, and then suddenly the momentum takes off and the boat is heading in the right direction, and suddenly everything's OK. Perhaps those sort of things. And I think there are many submariners who can talk about those sort of things. Operationally, a couple of times, there have been moments where, again, you wondered what's going to happen next. But it's always, at the back of it all, it's the professionalism, the training and the experience of people that sort of takes over. And you look around you and you just see everybody else totally trained, totally concentrating on their bit to get you out of what perhaps is a tricky situation.
One of my jobs, prior to diving, everyone has a place to be, everybody. And my job at the time as an engineer was to stand under the main access hatch and check for leaks. So as we were going down and down and down, well, fortunately, it never leaked, of course. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether the seniors on board were just getting me on a wind-up, but I had to report back every 5 minutes. No, the hatch is still dry. Well, of course, the amount of pressure on the hatch, the seal gets better and better the deeper you go. It's never going to leak or pop, but that was one of the jobs, and I often gave it some ponder. What if that actually did start to leak? Well, it would be game over, of course, but no, it never did, fortunately.
I'm not sure I was ever scared as such. I guess there was always something in the back of your mind that if you were in a war scenario and you talked about whole boats being lost, well, I don't think there's any other way around it. If a boat gets hit, then either 90% of people come home or none of them do, because that's just the way you are. If you're down at that sort of depth, you're not going to get out of it. So possibly there, that is in the back of your mind. But, of course, we weren't in a shooting war at the time, and we were never particularly close to a shooting war, so maybe that little background fear never had to come to the fore, if you like. If you dwelt on that for any length of time, then you wouldn't want to go back to sea again.
There were occasionally times where the submarine, your instinct cut in, and people talk about the hairs on the back of your neck, and you could recognise that something wasn't perhaps quite right. But again, the whole essence of being a submariner is the professionalism of the training, such that at no stage did it get beyond and into unsafe and therefore scary. It was training. There are instances, certainly operationally at times, where the opposition, as everybody says, always has a vote, and you're sitting in your submarine wondering what's going to happen next or how you're going to react. But I go back to the very first few days in submarines when I didn't really know what I was doing and I was learning, and there were a couple of instances then whereby ignorance of what was going on, perhaps my heart rate would have gone up considerably faster than it would have done 15 years later, as I'd seen it all before or understood what was happening, and actually that what might to some people look to be a situation that was appearing to be out of control was in fact very much under control.
One senior engineer told me, this steel can is designed to get under the water and do it many, many times, whereas a ship only dives once. And that kind of put it into perspective. You know, you've got a very capable crew and they're amazing pieces of machinery that are very capable. So after a while, you sort of get used to the fact that it is a safe environment. In equal measure, you are aware there is a, you know, you've got big bombs, you've got a nuclear reactor. Fortunately, nothing ever goes wrong, and they're maintained to the nth degree. There's so many safeguards in place that actually you're probably safer on the submarine than you are in a lifeboat.
When you're trained as a submariner, you are trained to believe that you can overcome all the obstacles that will come your way, whether it be a fire or a flood or any dangerous circumstance. And I've done 26 years as a submariner, and there's been a lot of occurrences where incidents have happened, but we've always been able to make our submarine safe.
Silver Screen loves a submarine movie. However, for the most part, the mainstream films are not overly accurate of life on board. There is one film, however, that continues to show the essence and the emotions of serving under the waves.
Most submarine movies annoy the hell out of me, and I suspect it's the case with anybody who's actually done the job. The best submarine movie ever is Das Boot. It is 95% realistic of how life on board a submarine was, certainly during the Second World War, I can imagine, and on a small submarine like that as well, it would be. Whereas Hunt for Red October, they're standing in acres of control room with a little silver periscope in the middle, and it's stuff like that. There are always, in films, inaccuracies.
I have never been worried about a mutiny on board a submarine. I know the films you're talking about, Crimson Tide, there's that slightly bizarre moment with Denzel Washington appearing to be sort of finishing a half marathon, The Hunt for Red October with Sean Connery and the killing his political officer. Yeah, they're good films, they're great films, but that's no experience that I have had of submarines. If you were to ask me, and I suspect most of my generation would say the same thing, Das Boot is probably the best film to watch to understand what it's like to be a submariner.
BFBS, Original Forces Programmes.
A Submariner's Tale.
Since April 1969, the Royal Navy's ballistic missile boats have not missed a single day on patrol. The continuous at-sea deterrent means that one of the four Vanguard-class submarines are patrolling the world every day. It also means that for those in command of these boats, there is always the potential that they could be ordered to set off a chain reaction that would alter civilization as we know it. George Orwell famously said, "We sleep soundly in our beds because rough men stand ready in the night to visit violence on those who would do us harm." One of those four Vanguard-class submarines stands ready every single day of the year.
You don't try and dwell on those sort of thoughts, because at the end of the day, you've signed on the dotted line, you're drawing the Queen's shilling. We are here to do a job of work in the military, especially in the Navy. So you wouldn't have signed up to be a submariner if you didn't make that consideration. I didn't come across any conscientious objectors as such. I don't think they'd have lasted very long in the submarine service, but everyone was very committed to their job and understanding the implications of why we're there. At the time, as a junior rate, obviously, I didn't really give that two thoughts. I was there to do a job of work and enjoy Navy life, but I didn't think too deeply about the bigger picture. Obviously, now I'm older and wiser, I can see exactly why our nation has that capability, and I'd have no hesitation to do it all over again. As one captain told me, we're there to shoot the Queen's enemies in the face. Stirring stuff.
You're responsible for everybody. You're responsible for all the people. You're responsible for the routine and the running of everything. And, of course, if you've got those Polaris missiles sitting at the back there, and you are one of the two people mainly in the loop for authentication and of firing messages and saying, yeah, this is it, we need to fire these things. So, and the job is always just part of the job because you're always trained to do it. So you go through all these training courses and training procedures, and then it just becomes that's what you do. So if you've got no great moral feelings that what you're doing is wrong, and I don't think you can have and serve on those boats, then you just get on and you do it. You have to have the thought process once, but otherwise why would you go on a Polaris submarine? You shouldn't, especially not in the position I was in. So if you believe in the deterrent as a political concept, then you're out there, but you can't believe in the deterrent and not be prepared to fire the missiles. It doesn't, it ceases to be deterrent if you're not going to fire the missiles. So
no, you're out there to do a job. My job was to make sure the submarine was in the right place at the right time with all the equipment working, and what it did from then, yes, I was there to support it, but I didn't worry too much about it. If we were being asked to do something, it was on behalf of the government, it's to sort of, the will of the country. So, yeah, I was more than happy to do it.
I think it's one of those questions that I was never confronted with, so I never had to consider it myself. I know it's when confronted with it, a lot of my friends think, and you would rightfully expect them to do so, think long and hard about it. But at the end of the day, it's all about a deterrent, and if you're bought into the principle of deterrence, then you're bought into the principle that if it came to it, you would absolutely press the button, because that is the underlying principle of deterrence. But again, what backs up deterrence is the fact at the back of your mind you know that if deterrence work, you will never be invited to make that decision.
Living in close quarters and a high-pressure environment without doubt leads to the forging of lasting friendships. And as with anyone who has served in any military unit, these friendships and memories do not diminish.
When we work hard, we work hard, but when we play, we equally play hard. And we do get up to some jolly japes in our off-watch time. So one thing that does stick in mind, a particular captain who I'll keep his name out of it, when we were in America, decided that it would be a good idea to water ski behind his submarine, which he pulled off, which was quite amazing. And then he proceeded to show everyone the video at every cocktail party thereafter. So it's things like that. It's the stuff we get up to, as well as the good work that we put in.
Being a submariner had always been the very sharp end of operations, and I certainly saw a few of those more in my younger time. And those were professionally very rewarding. I was navigating, I had the privilege of navigating HMS Triumph. I was a very new Trafalgar-class submarine in the early 90s, and we did the first of what are now almost routine East of Suez deployments, with 3 weeks alongside in Perth, followed by 10 days in Singapore. So from a sort of recreational perspective, that was probably the highlight of my career. But actually, I look back with fond memories to my very first submarine, which was the conventional submarine HMS Odin. I was only on board her for a year, but, my gosh, did you learn the trade of submarining in a conventional class submarine. So lots of experiences, mostly great fun, some that nobody would wish to talk about, but it's been great. I have had a great time in 20 years in submarines.
The time I look back fondest is many of the patrols. Patrols, especially as a bomber, as they call it, on the Trident fleet, is long, 3 months away, no contact from the family, and you're effectively on a war footing every day and practicing it. However, the corps d'esprit, the ethics, knowing everybody, and that environment in the submarine is something that is you just enjoy.
I've taken part in a few different exercises where we
We're trying to capture pirates and drug runners off the coast of Africa. We've dropped special forces into harbours. We have conducted various different exercises all over the world. So it's nice to be useful and it's nice to go at sea and achieve aims. But with that as well, I've gone down to the Falkland Islands, I've been to America and the Caribbean. I've achieved going to different places and seeing the world, which as a submariner is rarer than you'd think.
Taking command of submarine, I remember the very first day picking up the phone and sort of saying Tyler's captain was a great sort of moment for me, because when you join in the warfare branch and you join submarines, your very aim is to pass perisher, the submarine command course, and of course having passed that, hoping that you're then selected for submarine command. So for the first half of my career, I would say that was almost that sort of single-minded professional focus, was to pass perisher and then get a command of a submarine. So yeah, very special moment. I had a great 2 and a bit years in command, but again, I felt comfortable during the whole time because of the amount of training, the amount of experience I had had to get there.
In 30 minutes, I can but try to bring you a few submariners' tales. I have, of course, scratched the surface. The willingness of men and women to go on and under the sea in the defence of the realm continues in our modern Royal Navy. But ask anyone in that Royal Navy, and most will agree, the submariner service is a very unique band of brothers indeed.
Whenever you see a submariner, there's a source of respect, and it doesn't matter whether it's a submariner in the UK, in the Royal Navy, or whether they're French or American or Russian. You know, submariners all have that same corps d'esprit and understanding of the environment and where we work.
I think the fondest memories are of the companionship and the sense of belonging to a small unit while you're operating at sea. Life is generally far more, maybe relaxed is the wrong word, but it's far more the fact that everybody knows their job and they get on, and respect comes from knowing your job and how you do it rather than from rank necessarily. So everybody knows everybody else, you know everybody's little... foibles is a good word. The feeling of being part of a small elite team, if you like.
The submarine service is like a band of brothers. It's a different navy to the surface fleet. We're a bunch of very highly trained, highly professional people, and you have a camaraderie that exists because of that. We're all in that little sausage can for a lot of hours, and you form very close bonds and relationships with very professional and committed people.
Everybody starts knowing probably nothing about submarines. It doesn't matter whether you're a young boy or girl, officer or rating, you all start knowing absolutely nothing. The training and the experience that you gain at the beginning is absolutely the same. The experiences are the same. You are stuck inside the submarine, and it doesn't really matter whether you are a stoker at the back end of the submarine or forendy right at the front or wherever you are, you have shared that experience. I don't think you can say that in a surface ship to the same extent. When Nelson spoke about his band of brothers, he was talking about his commanding officers, and he was talking about the likes of Sir Thomas Hardy, Sir Edward Berry, all those famous captains in those days. In the submarine service, we talk about a band of brothers, and it's a very different band of brothers. It's absolutely everybody. So it's the youngest submariner, most recently qualified, boy or girl with their dolphins on their uniform. They are as much a part of the band of brothers as the oldest surviving 93-year-old World War II submarine CO who's still alive today. We are all a band of brothers. I was that which others did not wish to be. I went where others feared to go and did what others failed to do. I asked nothing from those who gave nothing, and reluctantly accepted the thought of eternal loneliness should I fail. I have seen the face of terror,
felt the stinging cold fear, and enjoyed the sweet taste of a moment's love. But most of all, I have lived times others would say were best forgotten.
At least someday I will be able to say I was proud of what I was, and will always be one of the few, that happy few,
that happy band of brothers.